On RN, this is David Rutledge saying hello and welcome to this week's edition of Encounter. Volunteering in a developing country has become one of the more popular holiday options for young people taking time out from their studies. It's all very admirable, but overseas volunteering has also become a multi-million dollar travel industry in its own right, and it has an unsavoury underbelly that might not be so obvious to your everyday idealistic volunteer. So today we're asking volunteers about their motivations, their ethics and their experiences, and finding out that what they see isn't necessarily what's happening on the ground. The program's produced by Kerry Stewart.
Would you like to make a difference in local communities abroad while learning about a new culture and having fun?
I'm really looking forward to the challenge of teaching the kids. Like, I have really no experience in teaching them, so just sort of like learning the skills in that, and just like, it's going to be hard, and I know that, and I know there'll be times when I'm really like down, but the accomplishment at the end of just realizing, like, you know, you could achieve what you wanted to and everything like that.
Whenever you go, you choose a project including teaching, care, conservation, medicine, journalism, building and law. No prior experience is required.
Small, small things that we can do make a big, big difference to these people's futures. It's really exciting. I think you could go to a country and make a difference even if you only gave a day or two.
You realise, man, we could do something really decent in partnership with these people, you know?
You can make a difference.
A few examples of online promotional videos made by volunteer tourist companies. They specialise in adventurous and rewarding experiences for young people wanting to take a gap year from their studies. Volunteer tourism sounds worthwhile, but ethical and possibly religious issues come up when choosing who to go with, how long to stay, and what project to be involved with.
My name is Daniela Papi. I'm the founder of Pepi Tours, an education travel company in Cambodia, and a co-founder of Learning Service, an education and advocacy group working to help people rethink volunteer travel. I started volunteering abroad, I think my first trip was in 2002. I've volunteered in Nepal, Sri Lanka, Papua New Guinea, Thailand, the Philippines. I just kind of got hooked and I thought it was the best way to travel. So when I came to Cambodia in 2005 and organized a bike trip with some friends, we thought, well, we might as well volunteer along the way. And Cambodia was the first place that I stuck around long enough to kind of analyze and observe the longer term impact of my own personal volunteering and also thousands of other people that started to come through the country to volunteer as well. So over the course of the 6 years I lived in Cambodia, we shifted our volunteer travel company to become an education travel company. So instead of saying, come save the world in a week or a month or however long someone's break is to go volunteer, instead, come abroad, learn about the complexity of aid, development issues, and walk away with a more nuanced understanding that this stuff is really difficult and actually we can't do it in a week. We have to make efforts to do this for the rest of our lives.
I'm Stephen Waring and I'm at the University of Technology, Sydney. I'm an associate professor in the UTS Business School and I suppose my speciality is social sciences in natural resource management and some of those areas that fall into that are ecotourism and volunteer tourism.
And you've done a lot of research into, I suppose, the huge growth in that area of gap year students, university students taking perhaps a year off to do this sort of work.
Well, gap year was probably in the private schools in England, was originally where it was traditional. So they're reasonably wealthy in England, have been doing it for a long time, and it's quite a big industry in England. I think with Operation Drake and Operation Rally, which were two adventure-based organisations out of England that took that all over the world, it's now expanded that gap year to a whole range of other countries. And so we see, say, in Australia, where you'd now find it's becoming quite common for students finishing high school to take a gap year or finishing university to take a gap year. So it's expanded quite considerably, and as a result, there's a market for that. So industries then had a look at that and said, well, how can we attune to that? And so there's a really big market in gap year experiences, usually in a developing country. And also I think parents are really happy. I think gap years become something that students want to do. Like my son wants to have a gap year, but I think he sees it playing computer games, whereas parents see something organised where they're going and doing something that seems to be positive for them is a lot better option than just having a gap year to do nothing. And I think affordability, baby boomers can afford to have their children take a gap year for a year. They're wealthy enough to be able to afford to have that happen.
Okay, Kerry, I'm Jackson Fitzpatrick. I'm just a student at Sydney University. I'm 19 years old, just about to be 20, and just studying international and global studies and trying to focus on Indigenous affairs and government international relations and hopefully go into Indigenous policy development after school. Just work at a couple part-time jobs and down a skate shop and do a couple tutoring jobs and things like that. And there's no real two ways about it. I've come from a very privileged background. I mean, I've grown up in the snobby suburb of Mossman, which is a wonderful suburb. I've got great friends there, but it's not the most underprivileged place in the world, to be frank. And then I went to Shaw School, which is a private boys' school, predominantly Anglo-Saxon in North Sydney. I've pretty much lived in a bubble my whole life, and I've got a wonderful family, very supportive, and I've got a great community and great support all around me. I've been exposed to all sorts of wonderful opportunities, traveling the world and on French exchange. So I've been absolutely privileged by that and humbled by my opportunities, and I never really knew what I had until got a bit older and finally got exposed to the Indigenous landscape in Australia, which is what really stung true with me. So I started volunteering with AIM, Australian Indigenous Mentoring Education, and a couple of local organisations down in Sydney, and then wanted to get out bush and experience the real thing. I did one semester of university and then left the day after my exams and spent 5 months up in the Northern Territory in a couple of different communities. I went up through VOICE, which is Volunteers in Community Engagement, and they're really good because they're really against that sort of slogan we're just talking about saving the world and tourist development opportunities. They really want cultural immersion. Staying 4 weeks is the shortest program they offer, I believe, and then it goes up 6 week and 10 week, and then they facilitate you coming to community. They help you get your, for example, if you, when I was going to Indigenous Australia, they help you get your Aboriginal Land Council permits. They set you up with training with local people, and they have a 24-hour contact service that I never actually used because I felt fine. And they've got programs in Cambodia and Vanuatu and a bunch of other places like that.
My first two international volunteer trips were both building trips, so trips where you were building homes for people. I did that in Nepal, in Papua New Guinea, and in the Philippines as well, actually. And the best thing I got out of those trips was this experience of getting to work with your hands. You know, I think that's a large reason that people want to do building, painting, volunteer trips. We have so many people that work in offices, work behind a computer, who don't get the satisfaction of a physical labor project where you get to see something that you've built be created day by day. And you get strong and you're outdoors and you feel like you're more connected to the work that you're doing. The other reason that I loved those trips was an opportunity to meet local people in a way that was much different than I had in the past. Every other trip I'd taken in the past was about being a tourist, taking pictures, experiencing a place, buying some souvenirs, and most of my interactions with local people were therefore based around that person selling me something or that person taking me to a site and being paid to be my guide. So this was an experience where we were working together to build something, and it felt like it had a lot of meaning. You could extrapolate a vision of the future where this home would be lived in by a lovely family that was in some way touched by or maybe improved by your efforts. and which is satisfying. I mean, I think that's a huge reason that people do volunteer travel. It's definitely one of the reasons I did, is that you feel like you're giving back in some way.
The multi-million dollar industry of volunteer tourism, or voluntourism as it's called, has been under the spotlight in the last couple of years. A report by Demos, a think tank in the UK, has said that poorly arranged gap year programs in developing countries are at risk of doing more harm than good for the host communities. This sort of travel has even been described as a new colonialism, a new way for the West to assert its power. So what does Associate Professor Stephen Waring from UTS think?
I think it's a little bit naive. Like, I don't think I've seen any good research that's tracked communities through, you know, say 15 to 20 years to just to see what has happened. But yeah, there is a little bit of truth to it. It's certainly, in a lot of cases, communities rely a little bit on that volunteering and then start to rely on that more and more. But the other side of that is a lot of the projects that get done would not get done by those communities if they didn't have the volunteers. So trying to get that balance in volunteering is difficult. So yeah, I think there is a need for research in that area, but it's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, World Bank has done something like 700 community-based ecotourism projects in the last 40-odd years, and they would say 85% of them have been failures, and that they don't have good evaluation techniques to look at how they evaluate that with communities. There's no tools and models that really do a good job. And so I think volunteer tourism has experienced that same thing. How do you evaluate the outcomes for those communities? Because those communities are also changing at the same time. Like, they're getting information outside of just the volunteer tourists, and so they're moving towards progress for them.
I sometimes call the type of volunteer travel that's being sold to young people now, I call it moral imperialism. You know, it's this idea of this moral requirement to give our time to those in need around the world. And it is sold in a way that is using superhero-like images. You know, come save people, come help. My advice to parents or young people who are looking at gap year programs and trying to choose where they should go is find ones that are more honest about what you're really going to be able to do in the world. If a program is selling you an opportunity to save the world, turn around and go the other way. Sending especially young people abroad is essential for peace in the future, for global understanding, for cultural awareness. Right, so I'm so supportive of the exchanges that come from international travel. I think those exchanges are hindered when one group of people that is doing the traveling thinks that it's their responsibility to fix the lives and communities of another, when we're skipping this entire step of saying, you know, hello, we know nothing about that other person's community, life, language. What's been tried there before? What's working? What's not? Who's leading these changes? It shouldn't be us.
If you talk about volunteer tourism projects, well, everybody says, well, they may have high impact, but in a lot of cases, a lot of it's 7-8 hour laboring days, you know, where you're working, and young people do that really well. And people with skills don't do that really well. So volunteer tourism in that generation Y, they're contributing if they're on good programs. So, and the communities appreciate that, the fact that you've got youth there that are actually doing real physical work.
If you're searching through companies that are trying to offer you an option between 15 different countries and volunteer programs around the world, how is that travel company really vetting and making sure that these projects are aligned with local initiatives? So I would just suggest really doing your research. And then the counterpoint to that is being willing to admit when, I might have made a poor choice here. Being willing to step back and say, actually, I think my interaction in this place is maybe causing more harm than good. And I'm going to backtrack here and not continue to fuel and fund that type of work. And being open about it and speaking up about it afterward. Because other people can't learn unless we're sharing that knowledge.
Palms Australia sends volunteers overseas for 2 years in response to requests from communities that want to build skills and knowledge for particular local projects. So are there voluntourist companies operating in the regions where Palms volunteers live and work? Roger O'Halloran is the executive director.
We have organisations who would like to visit our volunteers, so much so that they could spend a great deal of our volunteers' time and volunteers' communities' time in hosting them. There's a lot of students and others, people with no particular skills. A friend of mine once commented on a group of students who were going to World Youth Day, and someone had the bright idea that they would not just go to World Youth Day, but they would make a contribution in some way to a community in the place that they were going. I think it was Brazil. And they decided that they would build, of all things, they built a church for the community. And as my friend commented, these kids wouldn't be allowed to build a toilet here. Why do we have the sense that they can go and build someone's church? So, yeah, we see it and it's a little bit despairing. I mean, local community are pretty clever with it, though. Our local communities, we do find, get what they can from it. And so they might play on the charity of the people who are around. They sometimes hit them up for a particular project that they think they might be able to support in the local community. That's with funding, and or funding after they return home, asking them to send money. Always a bit of a danger, because it creates a sort of a dependence, this notion that the white people coming from somewhere else, this cargo cult mentality, that they can bring stuff for us and we don't have to do anything. They just bring stuff. There's not many benefits, even for the people who do go, who come back with, wow, you should have seen that, stories. They really haven't got what they did see. They don't really know what they saw. They saw what the organisers wanted them to see, and they very quickly come down from that and find that they get on with their lives here, and it's just an experience they had.
I also went to the Tiwi Islands for 1 week, but that was more volunteer tourism. It was a great experience. I went straight there from the outstation, which is very harsh living conditions. But then Tiwi Islands, I went up through Macquarie Bank, and they've got a fantastic program up there. They raise all this money. They do this incredible garden sustainability project with the Tiwi College up there on one of the main islands. So they teach the kids to cook and harvest their own food, healthy. They get them through to year 12. They've reduced the suicide rate up there phenomenally. They've done some fantastic impact. But myself, my personal role up there was very much all about nothing. I coached rugby for a couple of hours each day, and I set up some cones, but I mainly hung out and went swimming in the local creek. I mean, I hadn't been swimming for months out in the desert, so finally going up to Tiwi Islands up on top of the Northern Territory, it was so nice to be in the water again, but it was a very different experience. I went up with some rugby stars and cricket stars, which was great, but it was simply 5 days in out on a charter plane, fancy dinner to finish, fancy things all around, really. It was a wonderful, wonderful week. I absolutely loved it, but I treated it more as a holiday than a volunteer project for me personally.
The problem is that it's too often volunteer travel is looked at through the travel lens, not through the development lens. But in actuality, as this sector continues to grow and thousands more people start going to these, all these different towns that have become kind of volunteer party central, then development work gets overtaken by this volunteer travel initiatives. You have areas where you have young people staying in these kind of volunteer hotels where you can volunteer by day and party by night. In Cambodia, I've seen so many gap year young Australians, Americans, Brits running around in bikinis, walking through 1,000-year-old temples, walking by monks, and yet, while that we're here to help, we're volunteering with kids during the day, but we want to express our own culture and run around half naked. I sound like my mother. Oh my gosh. And that shouldn't be happening. And it wouldn't be happening if those people were traveling with an organization that was saying, hey, listen, actually, the way that we help the world isn't just by doing something. It's this one thing. It's kind of like this carbon offsetting mindset. That's, in some ways, sometimes what we think about volunteer travel. Well, oh, it doesn't matter how I live during the year. I go once a year and I volunteer with orphans for 2 weeks. Who cares if I'm partying at night and fueling a tourism-based drug industry? All these kind of things that volunteer travelers, unfortunately, are getting involved in.
So what are young people's motivations to volunteer overseas? Do their ethical or spiritual beliefs play a part? Associate Professor Stephen Waring from the UTS Business School.
There's a little bit of altruism, and I've got a PhD student studying that at the moment, and she's in Cusco looking at backpackers and volunteer tourists, and she thinks that, yeah, it's a part, but she thinks more, for a lot of them, it's about CV development. So you've got medical students there that can work with medical projects. So research tends to suggest that a little bit more of the motivation for Christian groups and individuals is to be able to find like-valuing people. So other people that are more aligned to their Christian values. A little bit is about that altruism. I think it's more prominent in youth that are sort of have a Christian background. I suppose a lot of youth, and we deal a lot with that Gen Y group, are really interested in secular volunteer tourism or secular volunteering. We've been running Youth Challenge Australia since 1990, and we set that up mainly for our students to be able to go overseas and work. But the first question a lot of people ask is it secular? We wouldn't know if they, you know, had a Christian set of values that motivated them to come to work with us. It's not something we'd think to ask these days. But it's the first question they seem to ask when they're asking about that organisation. So I'd say that, yeah, to me, it comes across as a little bit of a negative perception of the Christian base. And that may be the fault of the church in terms of the way it's set it up. It has that 30 to 50 year ago perception of what church groups do in developing countries. So I think that that's part of the problem. The church hasn't really marketed themselves to this century's generation, and particularly Gen Y.
Who volunteers for PALMS?
We're open to anyone who wants to come and share our values.
Do they have to be Catholic?
No. You know, some criticism for us from those that are in the church today saying that, you know, we're not putting on our website very clearly that we're Catholic. We've sent away Buddhists, we've sent away people who are proclaimed atheists, but they identify with the values, interestingly, which do have a historical base in the Catholic social teaching. So it's perhaps a bit of an eclectic organisation in that way, and much to the chagrin of those who would want it to be much more firmly Catholic. But it's not something that we wanted to change. For example, we're being requested now to send volunteers into a community that's largely Hindu. They like our values, and we can see a lot of connection with their values. And in fact, you know, if people want to explore the spiritual in some ways, they're restricted sometimes by their own faith, and that looking at others, they can perhaps see paths to better understanding.
I grew up in a religious family, grew up as an Anglican Christian. My family raised me that way. You know, we used to go to church every Sunday, and Shaw School is also an Anglican Christian school. However, I don't believe myself, you know, if I'm going to be completely honest, I don't think I'm the most devout of Christians out there. My experience volunteering out in those communities wasn't altogether about my Christian background, if that wasn't my real motivation for it. I mean, sure, lessons taught there did apply, but it was more about understanding their spirituality. So Walpuri and Luritja spirituality, which is two of the indigenous cultures up there, that are two of the main countries I stayed at.
So my name is Michael Galuzzo. I'm 27 years old, and I was born and grew up in a little town called Narandra in the Riverina. My mum is Wiradjuri from that country, Narangara, and my dad's a Calabrese man from the south of Italy. After finishing high school in Narandra, I moved to Canberra to study a double degree in arts law at ANU. I recently finished that degree and now working at the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Healing Foundation.
And can you describe your journey as a volunteer to India, and who went with you?
There were 16 volunteers. In that 16, there were four Aboriginal volunteers coming along. So Trent, Kelly and Laurel and myself were on the Aboriginal volunteering program.
I just wanted to apply because it sounded like a great opportunity that would help me to become a better leader in my community, which my community needs.
The project that we're actually going over for was the Youth Project of Australian Volunteers International. And we're actually working with student partnerships worldwide. So we turned up in Vellore, which was the closest town to the village we would be working in, greeted by about 12 Tamil volunteers. And we did a one-week kind of cultural immersion, I guess you would say. It wasn't a lot to prepare us for the village that we'll go to. The village that we went to was called Tandiyankotai. We affectionately called it TK. That was mainly because some people couldn't pronounce it correctly. But TK became our home for the next 2 months.
In my time in Cambodia, I came across a lot of groups that had religious motivations. There's some evangelical groups that would require Cambodians to convert to Christianity and attend church. And, you know, there was all these rules they had to follow in order to be able to access the free food they were giving or free computer classes or training for women. But I also saw some of the best development work in Cambodia from nuns or just religious people who were motivated by a belief in a religion that also gave them a belief of their responsibility to help others, but with a very kind of long-term approach. You know, one of my heroes and mentors in Cambodia set up an organization called RDIC, Resource Development International Cambodia. And he and his family lived in a rural community for more than a decade. And he taught me about just patience and listening. And you know, he spoke the language fluently. He sent his kids to local school and then also homeschooled them later. He was living his Christian values in a way that actually I had rarely ever seen before. So I think people's moral compasses and moral guides are essential, wherever that comes from. If that comes from a religious belief, spirituality, or your just own moral inclinations.
So what was your motivation? I mean, why did you decide to do it?
The two reasons that I went, firstly, was for the adventure and for exploring new parts of the world and really allowing that adventure to help me understand who I am. The other side was that there was a need. If a community expresses a need and I'm able to help, then I believe that we as Australian citizens, we as human beings, as an Aboriginal person, we all have a duty to help when other people are in need.
Do you have a religious or spiritual practice, and has that played a part in your volunteering work?
I wouldn't really call myself religious. I mean, I believe that people should be ethical. I believe in a God, a Christian background in terms of how I was raised. But I wouldn't necessarily call myself a religious person. But I guess what really affects me in terms of volunteering is the way that I was brought up. And the way that I was brought up was to value community, whether that's your local community, whether that's the community that surrounds your family, or whether that's the global community. But really, ethically, that's where my motivation comes from.
It wasn't until Vatican II in the Catholic Church that there was a sort of a recognition that lay people might actually be involved in living out their faith in some way. And in those days, it was the only way that it could be imagined that it would be done was as missionaries. Now, this term implies a sort of carrying of faith into other communities. And I suppose they had a sense that they were going to do that. And I think if you ask anyone even today who doesn't think too much about the term, they imagine the mission, if you like, someone travelling in a canoe down the middle of a river with a, you know, a cross in their hand and looking to convert the heathens. So that while we want to talk about the notion of mission within our organisation, that's not the notion of mission we're talking about. We have a mission to engage with others respectful of their particular culture and beliefs and understandings. In fact, with an open attitude, and this is why today we've taken the idea that Palms is actually opening our hands to the world, where we can learn from others about ways of life that they've lived and understand from that ways that we might find appropriate for our own lives to improve our own lives.
In fact, I don't like travelling, so I tend to only go when I have to, and usually for long periods of time to do volunteer work. I don't mind going to work with communities, but I don't really travel as a traveller that well.
Why don't you travel well?
My father was with the British and Foreign Bible Society, which has really became was Methodist Church Minister, then Uniting Church Minister. So he took 3 years up in Non-Territory to work, and so we were up there in two Aboriginal communities when I was really young. And interesting, when people came to visit those communities, the question the elders always asked, why do you come here? Don't you like where you live? So I've always been interested in, you know, why particularly Western neoliberal societies, people travel all the time. I've always determined to live where I wanted to be so that I didn't need to travel. And part of it's a sustainability issue. It's about if we get on a plane every time we want to go somewhere, the resources that get used to do that is quite significant. So I suppose I invented the phrase, you know, the real ecotourist stays at home.
Simon McKenzie is a Lutheran pastor who's just spent 8 years in Narn province in northern Thailand as a missionary. So what was his motivation?
The root of it is really Matthew 28:18, go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptising them in the name of the Father, Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to keep what I've commanded you. So that sense that who we are as Christians identifies our place in the community, in the world, as people who proclaim the gospel, as people who tell about good news that can transform and shape people in the most extraordinary ways.
So it was about growing the church, partly.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Yes and no. My agenda isn't to grow the church. In fact, that's actually God's job. I'm just simply called to proclaim the good news, and the work of the Spirit of God in that process will bring about change, and does bring about change. The Lutheran Church is actually one of the very big Protestant churches. There are missionaries virtually everywhere in the world, from various Lutheran churches around the world. So if you go to somewhere like Thailand, there's been missionary work there for 40 to 50 years, which makes us very recent arrivals in, say, Thailand. But if you look at other parts of Asia, we've been there for over 100 years. I was placed in Narn province in northern Thailand and placed to work with a minority group called the Lua people. They themselves were originally part of a kingdom which spanned down to the Mekong River, and so they became our family for the next many years.
And originally, what religion would they have been? Buddhist?
They're actually originally animist. In fact, Buddhism in that area was almost non-existent. So as a culture, they were quite different, and also being a minority group, historically quite different from other areas of Thailand.
Can you describe that theological shift before Vatican II? There actually was an idea by the hierarchy to grow the church.
Mm.
People did go in to convert others.
Mm.
The priests that were there in the missions did have a lot of power. And then there were some new thinkers. Can you describe those new thinkers and what they brought and how Palms adapted and changed?
One that I particularly found fascinating was a fellow named Anthony Gittins, who's an English spirit and priest, who spent a long time in a variety of places, and some of it in Papua New Guinea, actually. And he started to project this idea that we do learn as much as we can share with people. He actually now belongs to the Chicago Theological Union, where there are a number of people who are thinking about what mission is in that particular understanding of it, that we go as strangers into other cultures and communities, and we put ourselves in the hands of hosts there. And so we really go to make ourselves a little more vulnerable to understand others rather than go to preach ideas that we might have about the way the world works. Gittins, in fact, does some very good analysis of culture and how culture works, and gives a really good understanding, I think, of the way in which cultures can both allow us to operate effectively in our environment, but also can suppress us to some degree. When we go elsewhere, we kind of look back at our own culture and are able to see the areas where we are sometimes perhaps being controlled by the culture, and we become a bit more self-critical, and I think that's a fairly useful thing. So that's the sort of notion of mission that they're talking about today.
And what sort of projects did you do in Thailand?
For us, my role is actually a pastor. I'm an ordained pastor of the Lutheran Church, so I was there to shepherd the flock. and we're talking about membership amongst the Lua people, this minority group, who themselves were new as Christians and they needed to be cared for. And that's my role as a pastor.
And did people come from Australia and volunteer and help out? Was there a community of Australians as well?
Yes, there was a community of Australians who were connected up actually through Epping Church through prayer. And so then about 5 years ago, they sent the first team to Narn Province.
So talk about the volunteers. What did they do and who were they? Were they just members of the church or others as well?
Generally, obviously, our focus is Christian participation in these missionary groups, but we're open to other people attending, and the agenda was always very clear. People were volunteering for these missionary groups to work hands-on in the communities where we were working as missionaries. So they do simple things like rebuild a house, pave a road, cut down brush and timber in a paddock that was being prepared for a worship site, build fences, in some cases even dig holes for toilets.
Did everyone benefit from the support, or were it just members of the church?
No, this was always very much a community effort, and the spin-off was the cross-relational relationships with both the local Christians but also the local community. So, in fact, in many of the working bees, you'd have the local community coming together to help, because this was benefit for the local communities as well.
What are Palm's volunteers' motivations for going to volunteer?
The volunteers' motivations has actually been researched through a doctorate thesis, actually, by Dr. Nicole Giorgio. It was done by the University of Wollongong and Palm's together. Look, their motivations vary greatly. I don't think any of them indicated that they were trying to impose faith on somebody else. I'm pretty sure none of them did. And many of them would have said and did say that they were interested to see another way of life, because they'd thought that they'd exhausted all the possibilities and they wanted to see just what else. And that's, you know, an ideal that maybe is too idealistic in many ways. I think I had that sort of motivation before I went away and found that other cultures are as flawed as ours and other faiths are as flawed as ours. But also have very positive aspects to them that did help me understand a little bit more about. But, you know, there's no idealistic culture, no idealistic faith, no one ideal. So the diversity helps us to learn and understand better things. And look, in passing on their skills and sharing some opportunities that they have had in their lives, that was a big one.
What about a sense of reward in the afterlife, going to heaven, or to gain admiration from others, or perhaps a feeling of guilt over their comparative wealth?
Yeah, look, you see that in people. I don't know how much of it you see in volunteers. I suppose we could be a little quick to indicate to them that those aren't motivations that are really going to make them effective. We do have, I suppose, particular personality types that I call the need to be needed, you know, that people who feel that they can help. And they're the ones often that we're most wary of, because they help despite people needing help. They don't ask others what help they need. They just go and help.
Where I think it is tricky is if your religion or beliefs create an exclusivity. I want to share a story with you about a group of students who traveled with us from Texas. Many of them had never left the country. Some had never even left the state or the area that they're from. And they were so eager to learn and so excited about their travels, and that was fantastic. But we visited a Buddhist pagoda, and we were visiting some monks who were going to give us a blessing for our trip. And a number of these students wouldn't even enter the area where we were doing the blessing, and some decided not to get the string tied around their wrist that was kind of symbolizing the intentions to protect us as we went on our travels. But afterward, we had a chance to sit down with one of the monks. And one of the monks had actually traveled to America. He'd studied at a Christian university. And he talked about how he would go to church and he would meditate and his friends would pray. And he talked about the tenets of Buddhism and he correlated them to the tenets of Christianity. And the students were all, you know, taking notes and asking questions. And when we walked away that day, I remember, I mean, this was one of the most transformative experiences that I had the privilege to be able to watch and be a part of. And
the students were talking about how their parents and their community and people that they'd encountered before they left Texas had told them to watch out for people of other religions, or that, you know, they'd been told all their lives that people of other religions don't have the same moral code as Christians. And what they'd found was that actually it was their own myopic look at the world that had prevented them from realizing that this man and others in other religions had opened up to them to that idea actually have a lot of the same moral compass that they have. And I think that is the best thing that we can get out of international travel, is challenging our own biases, prejudices, assumptions about what we think is right and why we think our way is the right way.
I started off with Alice Springs. I did a couple of days of cultural training with a local Walpi woman there, which helped so much, so going onto community and understanding all the little things that you just wouldn't get growing up in a white background. So not making eye contact with strangers, not asking questions, understanding the cultural complexities of kinship and skin names, and that fits you into their sort of social order in the Aboriginal community. But I was fortunate to be exposed to a wonderful series of, you know, understanding men's business, women's business, sorry business, initiation, all sorts of things. And it's absolutely changed my life.
Sometimes people need to be taken out of their comfort zone to really see and understand what's great about their community, what needs to change, and what they can do about it.
During my volunteer time in India, I worked on a number of projects, and I think, you know, ethically for us, we needed to make sure that we listened to the community in terms of what they wanted. We couldn't go in and impose what the project would be.
And did you find that there are any common sort of situations or experiences that you've had or your community, Aboriginal community, has had, and your hosts, or was it very different?
There were some issues that were the same and there were some issues that were totally different. Whenever you're working on the other side of the world to where you're from your hometown, there's always going to be differences. But I guess the commonality was in that breakdown between generations, really culturally what different generations feel is the ethics of an older generation and the ethics of a younger generation. In my view, it's not necessarily better or worse, but essentially just different. The ethics of the younger generation are a lot around walking in two worlds, making sure that you have that knowledge about culture, about language, about the community as it was, but also about understanding the world changes and that culture isn't a static thing, and how our young people today here in Australia, in my community in Narendra, but also in the community in TK in India where I was volunteering, how that culture within the young people is changing. So you had a lot of young people that wanted to go and get educated out of the town. A lot of older people in that village wouldn't necessarily have had that opportunity. And so that wasn't really something a part of their world, but these young people have that opportunity now. And really that generational breakdown and that understanding is what was common between the two.
So when we started Pepe Tours in Cambodia, to be honest, it wasn't that different than a lot of the volunteer trips that I'd gone on before. We had funded the construction of a school building, and so in some ways we thought this was our building. I mean, we even called it, I think for the first number of years, we used to call it the Pepe School. And our trips at the beginning were about visiting the school, and we'd stop school for 2 days and we would teach English classes or Spanish classes and yoga classes and play games and kind of just take over the school for a few days, and there would be a lot of music and dancing and fun. It was very fun for the people involved, and actually, to be honest, this is the tricky part, is that it was also, in a lot of cases, you know, very, very fun for the kids and for the teachers. As we started to reconsider the impact that we were having by bringing unvetted foreign volunteers to play with kids in a remote Cambodian community, there was some pushback actually from some of the teachers. So this is a complex situation. They said, we enjoyed having you come in and playing with the kids for a few days.
But what we started to realize was that some of these things that might not seem like a bad thing and might actually be an interesting exchange once could be fine. But what if that once becomes twice a year? Is that okay? 6 times a year? Is that okay? 4 times a month? Is that okay? Who gets to choose when school gets stopped because the foreigners are coming? And how do you create a sense of ownership of the education of the children of the country if the agenda is being pushed by a foreign volunteer vacation schedule? And that's a lot of what we saw throughout our work in the most touristed regions of Cambodia, especially relating to situations of orphanage tourism, orphanage volunteering.
The world has to come here to support these people. They need it.
This is an online video by Jan Vandermeer, who is a voluntourism promoter. He and a group of tourists were taking food to an orphanage in Umbabane, the capital of Swaziland.
We bought carrots and onions, and we're going to buy chickens when we go somewhere else.
Yes.
So from fresh meat.
Fantastic. Great. Yeah, it's a good idea, this is.
I think it's a great idea. Yeah.
You bring it to the many orphans here, orphans who's got nothing, no parents, no food, no drinks. They're only supported by some friendly tourists.
When you get off a plane in a place like Siem Reap, Cambodia, and you walk into a hotel, you'll actually see that there are tons of advertisements for the sunny orphanage, the sunshine orphanage, the, you know, smiling kids orphanage, just lining the walls. And a lot of them will say free orphanage dance show or free orphanage visit or come support our children need your help. And you actually all of a sudden think, well, gosh, I'm a horrible person if I don't go do this. Well, actually, what a recent UNICEF report found was that in Cambodia, 76% of Cambodian orphans have one or more living parents, and a similar report in Ghana with higher numbers. So then the first initial thought sometimes of people is, oh, well, oh my gosh, this means that there's parents who've given up their kids. How horrible. Well, actually, it doesn't always look like that. What it sometimes looks like is a family with lots of kids living on an outskirts of a tourist town, and an enterprising orphanage owner going in and saying, I've got an orphanage, I'm going to feed your kids, they're going to get a good education, foreigners are going to come teach them. And parents are sometimes very capable of raising their child, but thinking that this is actually going to be a better opportunity for them. And unfortunately, with the most malicious opportunities are designed to keep kids looking in squalor, to keep kids looking like they're in poverty, because actually the places that are the poorest looking often get the most donations, because we travelers want to help the places in the most need. And so we end up funding places that are keeping their kids looking poor for the sake of our dollars.
Christian charity is also a worry, I think, in the way that some people do separate themselves as being more powerful, if you like, and therefore as givers, they adopt a position of power. And that's not an appropriate relationship. It's a worry that we do sometimes see on our television screens poverty represented by children with distended stomachs, and we adopt one image of a whole culture that they're poor. And that's all they are. They're just poor people. I can help them by giving from a little bit of my excess, and that makes me a good person. And it's a terrible, terrible attitude. They're fellow human beings who have skills and capacities and resourcefulness probably far beyond anyone living in a Western society, because they do deal with some difficult situations and difficult environments in which they live.
The Christian church groups have been doing orphanages in, say, Africa, in Kenya, for years and years and years. And what they do is they basically start that off with a long-term sort of approach where they connect a parish to a community and an orphanage in that country. They then develop over time So those relationships, so you may go work there and you may, when you work originally, maybe working on building. You won't have anything to do with the orphanage. Then over time, they might integrate some of those people that are coming back for return visits to sort of work with some of the orphans. And then what they may do is then attach a family to support one of those orphans so that they may go over and visit that or provide support for that orphan to education, so paying and helping assist pay for education. So there's a long-term relationship.
Is Palms involved in orphanages?
No.
Because there's a lot of difficulty in that area, certainly in Asia and Africa.
Yeah.
So what's your experience of that?
There are places where orphanages aren't required but are set up. And the reason they're not required is because extended families usually deal with any child who's had a loss of parent or parents. I recently read something on an orphanage in Cambodia. It was in the middle of a lake somewhere. I don't know if you've seen this, but they took boat trips out there and with tourists, and the children were to perform when each of the tourist groups came through. But before they got to where the children were at the orphanage, they were advised that the children needed bags of rice. So they spent money in this shop and bought the rice and then took it to the orphanage, and the rice was put into the orphanage and the children sang. And then the tourists moved on. Now, as far as the story went, it said that the rice was probably taken out the back door and back into the shop, and the children an hour later were singing for another group of tourists who had bought that same rice and put it into the orphanage. It's very sad that this is just playing to our need to give, and also it's our naivety and our lack of willingness to actually prepare for our engagement.
I also think the difference is in you. The difference is when you go home, you now have a new perspective.
The change in me has been more dramatic than the difference I've made sometimes.
It's when I'm hanging with people because I'm there for a reason. It really opens my eyes.
I think you come back humbler, and I think you come back more compassionate. I hope so.
And the problem is in this education of young people that saving the world is quick, that it can be done with little or no education about other people's needs, cultures, and communities, and that it should be led with our agendas. And if that's what we're teaching our young people through gap year trips, or, you know, even that we're teaching adults through trips for retirees, if that's how we're telling people the world should be changed, we're never going to be tackling the big problems that are facing our society now and will continue to face in the future that actually require a lot more long-term thought, preparation, education, and determination than a quick fix trip.
That brings us to the end of this encounter. You can find details about the reports and research mentioned in this program on our website. And I'd like to invite you to continue this discussion there. And I look forward to hearing about your thoughts and experiences of volunteerism. Technical production today was by Lila Schunner and Judy Rapley. I'm Kerry Stewart, and it's been good to have your company.
That's called voluntourism. Voluntourism is tourism and a bit of volunteering, and then you will see you like it and you do more. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Next week on Encounter, this year marks two grim anniversaries, 100 years since the outbreak of World War I and 75 years since the outbreak of World War II. Many historians believe that these two wars are actually better understood as one long war with a break in the middle. We'll be focusing on Germany and how the history of anti-Semitism can be understood in relation to this dark period of the 20th century. That's Encounter, Saturday at 5. And on RN, I'm David Rutledge. I hope you enjoy the rest of this Saturday evening. Stay with us for Away, coming up in just a few moments after the news.
Norman Swan here. Now, what I'd like you to do is take a selfie and have it in front of you after you've downloaded a podcast of the Health Report. It might give you some insight into whether you're not the warm, empathic person you imagine yourself to be, but are really a hard-hearted, emotionally incompetent sod. We'll also try to answer the question whether surgeons fit the stereotype of being cold and unsympathetic. Plus, good news for consumers of complementary practitioners. That's the Health Report, downloadable from RN's website.